next on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's Bathurst Spears Broadsides, the Sunday show, September 5th, 2004. Stay with us. Special interview with Mad in America author Robert Whitaker live by phone from Boston starting at 10 o'clock with panelist Jane Kaiser grilling the good writer. Not to mention Caribou, also in the studio. I'm Robert Norris. Stay with us.
A boy, I tagged along behind a gang of warmy corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow. Smooth as silk is creamy milk. Learn to coo, learn to moo. That's what you do to be a lady now. When I went to school, I learned to write and how to read some history, geography, and home economy. And typing is a skill that every girl should need to while away the extra time until the time to breed. Then they had the nerve to say, what would you like to be? I says, I'm gonna be an engineer. No, you only need to learn to be a lady. The duty isn't yours for to try and run the world. An engineer could never have a baby. Remember, dear, that you're a girl. She's smart for a woman. I wonder how she got that way. You get no choice, you get no voice. Just stay mum, pretend you're dumb. And that's how you come to be a lady today. Then Jimmy come along and we set up a conjugation. We were busy every night with love and recreation. I spent my day at work so he could get his education. Well, now he's an engineer. He says, I know you'll always be a lady. It's the duty of a darling to love me all her life. Could an engineer look after or repay me? Remember, dear, that you're my wife. As soon as Jimmy got a job, I began again. And happy at me turret lay the year or so. And then, the morning that the twins were born, Jimmy says to them, kids, your mother was an engineer. You owe it to the kids to be a lady. Dainty as a dish rag, faithful as a chow. Stay at home, you got to mind the babies. Remember, you're a mother now. Well, every time I turn around, there's something else to do. Cook a meal, mend a sock, sweep a floor or two. Holding out the potty when the baby wants to poo. I was gonna be an engineer. You know, I really wish that I could be a lady. I could do the lovely things that a lady's supposed to do. I wouldn't even mind if only they would pay me. And I could be a person too. What price for a woman? You buy her for a ring of gold. To love and obey without any pay. You get your cook and your nurse, for better or worse. You don't need your purse when the lady is sold. Ah, but now the times are harder and Jimmy's got the sack. I went down to Vickers, they were glad to have me back. But I'm a third-class citizen, my wages tell me that. And I'm a first-class engineer. The boss, he says, we pay you as a lady. You know you only got the job, cause I can't afford a man. With you, I keep the profits high as maybe. You're just a cheaper pair of hands. You've got one fault, you're a woman. You're not worth the equal pay. A bitch, you're tart, you're nothing but heart. Shallow and vain, you got no brain. You even go down the drain like a lady today. Well, I listened to my mother and I joined a typing pool. I listened to my lover and I put him through his school. But if I listen to the boss, I'm just a bloody fool. And an underpaid engineer. I've been a sucker ever since I was a baby. As a daughter, as a wife, as a mother and a dear. But I'll fight them as a woman, not a lady. Fight them as an engineer.
And that was Peggy Seeger. I was going to be an engineer I don't know if we had a bit of air silence prior to the show. If we did, well, I hope you all used it to meditate, this being Sunday. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We're broadcasting at 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org here in beautiful Santa Cruz from our carefully concealed spot, unlicensed, unapologetic, unashamed, and often unrehearsed. That seems to be the case today. We're going to roll anyway. And in the studio with me, I've got some fine guests. They're just sort of slowly getting ready, getting it together. One is going out for a nicotine break. I warned her about that, but what can you do with these smokers? The actual main attraction of the morning is Robert Whittaker's, and he's the author of Mad in America, Robert Whittaker. He has been on this show before, and he is articulate, I would say even brilliant, in terms of his writing. He's done, for those of you who've either followed psychiatric literature or anti-psychiatric literature and or this show, which is, we've been broadcasting for about, 8 or 9 years now, but last year we had him on talking about his book Mad in America. This year he's going to be doing a follow-up, talk about work he's done since then. He even had a book proposal called Anatomy of an Epidemic, which is a follow-up to his, I think, groundbreaking study, Mad in America, which is a compilation of different research literature showing the really grim history of psychiatric assault on the community, really. Misguided medical models, brutal pseudo-treatments that had the fullest medical recognition by the psychiatric and medical establishment of its day. I'm going to go into this later as we get closer to 10 o'clock, and I'm going to be playing some songs from Morgan Firestar. Morgan was a local psychiatric activist who killed herself in 1995, and she was a composer, she was a fighter for homeless civil rights, she was a fighter against the kinds of forced drugging, forced incarceration, and other forms of Abu Ghraib, before Abu Ghraib, here in Santa Cruz, which masquerades, and of course throughout the country, as treatment. I should also say that Robert Whittaker is not an anti-psychiatry guy. He actually came on board the situation trying to look at the situation objectively and see how he could account for some disparity in results he found in terms of the fact that World Health Organization studies showed a much greater recovery rate for remission rate for so-called psychiatric episodes of schizophrenia in third world countries than in Western countries, and the wasn't well understood by those who looked at it, and they did a second study, and they got essentially the same results. They found that the recovery rate was between 15% and 35% in Western countries, which heavily used psychiatric medications, and then in widely different third world countries which didn't, it was like 67%. And this led him to begin an investigation which hasn't ended to this day, and we're going to talk with him about that at 10 o'clock. Until then, however, we're going to kind of thumb our fingers, bide our time, and also alternately try to rush in some, updates, which I have plenty of, but very little time to give them, and frankly, I'm not as prepared for those as I might have been on a normal Sunday without this major guest coming on. So let's listen to a little more music. Here's Morgan Firestar singing her thoughts on the psychiatric profession and how it feels to be a patient and or a survivor, if you will. Stay with us. By the way, before you go, let me give you a couple of stats. Grab a pencil if you want to be a part of the 10 o'clock discussions with Robert Whittaker. That's going to require your having a computer, or you can call in after the show with your questions. My producer is out of town at Burning Man, burning things up, perhaps. I don't know whatever they do at Burning Man. I'm completely ignorant about that stuff. So she can't field calls, and there's only one phone line into the studio anyway, and that's going to be taken up by Robert Whittaker. But you can email me questions at rnorse3@hotmail.com, rnorse3@hotmail.com, or even better, you can go to pagesincolor.com. Pagesincolor.com is a chat room, and that means you can actually kind of join a bunch of folks asking questions. I will immediately pass your questions on to a group of folks here, including Robert when he shows up on the phone line in about 15 minutes. So, again, go to pagesincolor.com, www.pagesincolor, click on chat room and write in your whatever you want to call yourself. Currently, there are two people on the chat room, myself here in the studio, and Pages in Color, the guy who's running the chat room from his secret location. We won't give away any names here. So you might want to do that. If you can't do either of those things because you don't have a computer or for whatever reason, you can also jump on the phone and leave a message on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, group concerned with civil rights for poor people. And that is only a voicemail. But you can leave a question. I will try to pass it on to Robert. Admittedly, it's going to be later than the show, but maybe I'll get an answer for you anyway. He has got he's raised lots of questions. He probably has a few answers. We'll find out how that all shakes out in the next couple of hours. Also, coming up at 12, if all goes well, Sally Zinman, who has been an anti-psychiatric, I'm not sure what we call Sally. She's a worker with various psychiatric rights groups, and I wish I had her stats here, maybe when she jumps on the chat room, as I'm hoping she will, to give us a few questions for Whitaker. We can be more particular about her, or certainly we can talk to her when she gets online at noon. She's did a very good analysis of AB 1421, the state needles on wheels legislation that loosens psychiatric protections for those of us who are worried about psychiatrists and the police coming in to say, you're a little too crazy today, here are your meds, bend over and shut up, or go to the hospital or go to the court. And that actually is not, that was passed by the state, but has not been implemented in any county except L.A. in a very limited way. And she's going to be talking about that, plus what she regards as some positive developments on the psychiatric scene in terms of more facilities for people who are diagnosed or diagnosed themselves or are seeking psychiatric help, one way or the other, mental health-ish type help. So we're going to be talking about all of that, but let's hear a little from Morgan Firestar here again, pagesincolor.com. If you want to call this number, you can for the next 15 minutes if you have questions you want to put to me or to Robert Whitaker before the show. That's another option you have. Phone lines will probably be open, or actually they are open. They will stay open until 10 o'clock or whenever Robert calls in. The number is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. Yes, I loved you when their lives
Shelter from feeling the truth. Shelter from being abused. Yes, I lost you when you took their part. Swallowed your pills, hardened your heart. Trading dreams for drugs, like every mental patient does. Oh, my darling, it's the end of the line. I tried to help you, but I ran out of time. Loving is elusive when life is ruled by fear. I told you my opinion, but you didn't hear. And I lost you when their lies closed in, and they took away the pain of living. I'm ready to admit they win. Offering therapy, giving shelter, shelter from feeling the truth, shelter from being abused. Yes, I lost you when you took their part. Swallowed your pills, hardened your heart. Trading dreams for drugs, like every mental patient does. On my honor, your freedom was my goal. To trap you in a role. Now it doesn't matter, now that our trust has died. Ask your shrink what to think and how to say goodbye. And I lost you when their lies closed in, and they took away the pain of living. I'm ready to admit they win. Offering therapy, giving shelter, shelter from feeling the truth, shelter from being abused. Yes, I lost you when you took their part. Swallowed your pills, hardened your heart. Trading dreams for drugs, like every mental patient does. Oh, my darling, after so many years, your love and faith have washed away my tears. Start from where you all I can say. What we have, psychiatry can never take away. Yes, I lost you when their lights closed in, and you were afraid to go on living. Now I know they'll never win. Even if you take every drug they're giving, I know you better than they do. I put my money on you. Yes, I lost you when you took their part. But now we're standing heart to heart with our drugs and dreams, knowing just what freedom means.
And that was Morgan Firestar. And what's the name of that song, Jane? You know? No? Let me check it out here so people can actually know what they're listening to. It's called Dreams for Drugs from her album No Strings Attached. Well, we have about 7 or 8 minutes before the arrival of our guest of honor. So, a couple of announcements. Today is the Wham Fest, for those of you who go and kind of peer in the window of Wham! That you can't get into the candy store, but you can look in the window. Wham! Of course, is women and men against, what is it? And women and men, what's the proper, do we know the, come on you two, help me out with this. It's a medical marijuana group that I can never remember what the acronym stands for because it's so commonly called WHAM. Women and men for medical marijuana, perhaps. And it's run by the Corrals. It's got about, 250, 300 people in the group, and has been fighting a strong fight against federal intervention with some success, significant success. And I have been criticizing them locally because their connections with the city council and their impact on the local Santa Cruz City Council has been such as to encourage the council to essentially zone out clubs locally. So there is no distribution center. Wham! Is the only one, and it's not a distribution center. It's a closed club that has a long waiting list. But the cause of medical marijuana is definitely a good one. It's certainly good to defend Wham! Against the feds, but they also need a lot of criticism for essentially monopolizing the scene and closing it down for local folks who have to go out of town to try to get their medical marijuana or seek it illegally. And that has been a concern of mine for a long time. But you can check it out today. It's at San Lorenzo Park, and I believe it's being set up now. Don't know exactly when it starts, but it is starting soon. And it should be a nice warm day in the park. Wear your shorts, or perhaps nothing at all. That would be fun. That's what's cooking. Also at 11 a.m., for those of you who remember that there is a war going on in Iraq, and I guess we all do at one level or another, the Vigil Against Two Wars is supporting, I'm not quite sure if anybody from the Vigil is going to be there, but we are certainly supporting in spirit the Vets for Peace demonstration, or picket, that's happening in front of the Military Recruiting Center on 41st Avenue in Capitola. You might want to check that out. It's just the freeway side of the Capitola Mall on 41st Avenue, and they do it the first Sunday of every month, I'm told. At least that's what Carl of Vets for Peace told me a week and a half ago. Trying to reach Carl repeatedly by phone. I've not been able to reach him, but hopefully he is going to get a big turnout there today, and hopefully we can mount more such protests as we did a week ago with the Vigil Against Two Wars down on Pacific Avenue. Two wars. The other war, of course, is the war against the poor in Santa Cruz. So those are two events happening today in case you decide you want to be more active than simply sit next to your radio or dial in on your computer. But, you know, we've got some good stuff coming up here, too. There's also more news from the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. I hope to be able to play some stuff later, but I may not be able to because this day looks like it's going to be largely taken up, the show anyway, with concerns about psychiatric medication, the particular updates that Robert Whitaker has for us on the subject, the local reports from Caribou here and from Jane Kaiser, who I believe is that Mad Jane Kaiser? It is. That's your radio name. Okay. They're off mic at the moment, but they're in the studio getting ready to press their pernicious views on all of us and simply defame and disgrace those doctors who are just trying to help us get well. So keep that in mind. The New Street Spirit is out. That's a publication comes out every month, published by the American Friends Service Committee in San Francisco and distributed by homeless people so they can make a few coins to buy a cup of coffee or possibly some nice tampons or something else that isn't covered that they need that most of us take for granted. In any case, you might want to look for your street spirit vendor and fork out a buck or more, and you might learn something about what's cooking. There's an article that I wrote in the current Street Spirit about the no homeless parking laws, which have become the new approach by Santa Barbara and Santa Cruz authorities to deal with people who sleep in their vehicles or just people who sleep nearby who live in their vehicles. You can also reach Street Spirit at 429-8529 if you want to, not the editorial offices, but you can find a local distributor. We have a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, hi. May I speak
hello?
To Robert North?
Are you there?
Yeah, hello. May I speak to Robert?
Speaking.
This is Bob Whitaker.
Hey, you're a little early, Bob. Good to hear you.
Oh, I thought I was supposed to be at 10 o'clock.
Oh, well, maybe we're a little late. I mean, I think you're actually right on time. I'm going over time here. Well, good to hear you. You're live, so say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody.
And also in the studio, I'm going to set up this mic here, which my two panelists are going to share.
Terrific.
We have Jane Kaiser of Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. Say hello, Jane.
Hello, Robert.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
Fine.
She'll be closer to the mic in a minute. And we have lurking in the shadows is Caribou, who's going to make her way over to the mic soon. We have a very informal arrangement here.
Okay.
So you're calling from Boston?
That's correct.
And how's the weather there? Have you ended the war yet, by the way?
the weather here is great. And the second question, I'm sorry, I missed that.
What's that?
I said the weather here is great. We haven't got any of the Francis weather coming up here yet.
Mm-hmm. So are you in your home, or where are you calling from?
No, I'm in my office.
Okay, so you're working on Sunday, or just coming in to help us out?
Just coming in to help you out.
Well, I appreciate that. Wow. Well, let me do a little intro.
Okay.
I've talked about you earlier very briefly. I don't know if you can get us out there. We are, for anybody who's interested, at www.freakradio.org, if anybody's
right.
Suddenly deciding to rush to a computer to listen to us. I have your fine first book here, which is, I guess it was published, 3 years ago now, Mad in America?
Right, that's correct.
Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill. It has a fine photo of you in the front. And I've got so many different summaries of that book. I want to make sure I pass on something here that kind of gives people a taste of it. Let's see. Well, the reviewer himself writes, in Mad in America, award-winning medical journalist Robert Whitaker reveals an astounding truth. Schizophrenics in the United States currently fare worse than patients in the world's poorest countries, and quite possibly worse than asylum patients did in the early 19th century. Tracing over three centuries of cures for madness, from the Enlightenment-era practice of spinning the insane to the brain-damaging lobotomies and electroshock therapy of the 1930s, not to mention the tooth extraction, blistering, bleeding, purging, wrapping in wet sheets. My goodness, you have it's quite a collection of Abu Ghraib-type activities you've chronicled there.
It's a grim history, that's for sure.
And your main controversial finding that has made you persona non grata in the psychiatric world is your expose of the impact of various sorts of psychiatric drugs, showing that claiming or putting forth the proposition that the current psychiatric solution of the moment has the same kind of credibility to some extent that we would now view these older methods of quote treatment, like the terror treatment of the 1780s or removing organs in the 1920s, that
removing teeth, right?
And removing, well, I guess you mentioned at some point there were some even more than teeth were removed.
And it went from the teeth to other body parts. That's correct.
And other body parts. Yes, indeed. It sounds a little macabre. Go ahead.
No, that is exactly right. I mean, the common mythology that we have about psychiatric care in this country, and by the way, when I started this project, I believed this mythology, and that is that yes, there were the bad old days. And then, and that goes up to about 1950. But then we got the new psychiatric drugs, and things are much better now. So there's this sense that, yeah, things were bad in the past, mistakes were made, but things have gotten much better now. We have these new drugs that enable people to lead fairly decent lives. And I believe that wholeheartedly, but what you follow, and what I did in Mad in America, is if you follow the evidence forward, once we get these drugs, you do not see, in fact, a lessening of the problem of severe mental illness in this country. You actually see a worsening. That's the first thing you notice. And even when you don't have to probe very far before you find out people admitting that, in fact, say, outcomes for people diagnosed with schizophrenia are no better than they were in 1900. So very quickly, you see the myth belied. And that's one thing you find very quickly. The second thing, and this is what started me out on the book, is you find that people diagnosed with schizophrenia do much better in poor countries. And third, I mean, their long-term outcomes. And then what happens is when you start actually investigating our own research studies, you find that they don't support the paradigm that is delivered to the population that we need to be taking these drugs for life, people diagnosed with schizophrenia, say. And what you find, in fact, is that at least in a large percentage of people, that paradigm of care makes them chronically ill, worsens their long-term outcomes, and causes them to suffer any number of host of side effects. So you're right. I have, you know, that was a there were the powers that be were not happy to have that story put out there. But it's actually very easily documented. I mean, it just takes time, but it's documented in the research literature and in the medical literature, and that, in fact, is what is so surprising, is that you can follow mainstream scientific research, the studies that were done and funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, that show why, that since we embraced this paradigm of care, of drug-based care, that it hasn't led to a lessening of mental distress in this society.
One of my panelists wishes to ask you a question.
Sure.
Oh, yes, hi. My name is Caribou.
Hi, Caribou.
Hello. And I did read your book, Mad in America, last year, and I found it very revealing. I'll tell you a little bit about... Well, first I'd like to ask one of the critics of your book expresses that the condition of schizophrenia is not a real condition. And then I think it was your words saying that it might be a social construct rather than a real disorder. What do you say to Goldman's statement that the book was commissioned by Scientologists?
Oh, right, Goldman. Well, I mean, you know, that's just ridiculous. Let me take each of these. So first of all, this attack that the book is commissioned by Scientologists or something. I didn't interview anybody from the Scientology camp. I know virtually nothing about that group. I use none of their material, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. And in fact, you know, since I published the book, I've done a lot of speaking. And there was one group, in fact, I didn't agree to speak to, and that was the Scientology group, just because I wanted to make sure that there was no link there, that no one could paint me with this brush. And the reason they do that is because they try to discredit any sort of critiques of modern-day psychiatry by using that, saying, oh, well, you're a Scientologist or something like that. And it's just it's a smear tactic is what it is. And the reason they resort to this smear tactic is because, in fact, the evidence, their own evidence, the evidence that the trials they conducted don't support the story they're telling. So they can't argue on the evidence, so they pull out this smear tactic. And it's really, I mean, it just... It shows, I mean, here's a guy, Goldman, professor of psychiatry, et cetera. Imagine that you're stooping to that level. I mean, it shows the lack of integrity as far as I'm concerned. So, first of all, I have nothing to do with the Scientologists, know nothing about them, really, to be honest with you, use none of their material, and enough said about that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's how you feel. I'm relieved to hear that. I also, if I could tell you a little bit about my relation to that issue. In 1978, I think it was, I was suspected of being schizophrenic because I went to the Cleveland Clinic, and one of the other doctors saw that I hadn't shaved above my knee on my legs, and he said, I think you're schizophrenic.
Clearly.
Okay.
I
don't
calling the doctor,
think I've
yeah.
ever recovered from that pronouncement because I bought it for a while. I went through a lot of things and did stand up to throwing the drugs away, the medications that I was given over the next 2 or 3 years.
Right.
And then when I came to San Francisco from the Midwest, I went to a Scientology center, and they were going to refuse me because I apparently told them that I'd taken psychotropic medication. But they were impressed that I was not as affected as they had suspected a person that had been through that many medications would have been.
Right.
And so they did allow me to take one of their classes, and then...
Are you a secret Scientologist, Caribou?
And then I didn't like it, so I said, I'm done with this now. And I said, I want my money back. They also agreed to do that, so...
Let me ask something about that, and I know you had that was a two-part question she asked you, and you.
I do want to answer the social construct question.
Before you do, though, because that's a whole new another area. I think it's an important area. What's, you know, we've had a Scientologist recently on a local talk show talking about his concern about forced incarceration and forced drugging. You know, it's, aren't you putting the Scientologists into sort of the, you know, the communist bag, not wanting to associate with them? I mean, I know you want to maintain your credibility and all that, and frankly,
I can't
stand Scientology generally, because I think it's an authoritarian ripoff. But I also respect the fact that, you know, you get different allies in this struggle to restore civil rights to people. And what's wrong with the Scientology, you know, what's wrong with that kind of association?
You know, what I was answering was that I had no association with them, right?
Right.
And the point is, coming at this from a journalist, is you don't want to be associated with anybody, in a sense. In other words, you don't want to be coming at this, and I really didn't come at this with a goal, say, or a desire to fight a certain campaign. I really came at this as a desire to find out, answer a question, and that was, why are outcomes for people diagnosed with schizophrenia in this country worse than in countries like in India and Nigeria? I mean, that's a horrible failure. And also, you can see in just the question that there's something that we're not being told, because, of course, that's not the story we normally hear in this country. So coming at this from a journalist is, I just wanted to get at the facts, so to speak, and do that in as you know, cautious a manner as possible. So, in fact, I wanted to look at the mainstream research. And what I'm saying then in relationship to the Scientologist is, just because I begin with that sort of stance, I just want to make sure, A, that I don't get linked to any group. That's number one. But two, because they can use, because Scientology, I mean, you know, if you look at the Scientologists, and it's amazing, I know very little about them, this is the truth. But, you know, they have this campaign that is an anti-psychiatric campaign. Now, some of the stuff that I've read of theirs makes sense, okay? But then they have this other part that I don't really, you know, and again, I don't know much about it, this sort of Scientology, et cetera. And the point is that the mainstream people can tar you with your link to Scientology. It becomes a way of dismissing you out of hand. And so because of that, because it becomes a vulnerability, in my opinion, in order to continue just in any way write about this in a sort of very honest, very fresh manner, you want to make sure that they can't attack you in that manner. But so I'm not saying anything pro or con against the Scientologists. I honestly don't know enough about them. I don't really... It's amazing. I know very little about
well,
them.
Yet
but that's why I've tried to keep absolutely away from them.
Of course, the same argument can be used, you know, with respect to people like David Oakes of Mind Freedom,
yeah,
and
that's
anti-psychiatric
true.
People. So that's my concern. The same kind of smear can happen, you know, where they attempt to separate you from allies and people who have done research. They may have special access to grind, sure. But that doesn't necessarily discredit their research and their experience. And I notice you're going to be appearing in New York City on October 8th, 9th, and 10th at this ICSPP conference, which is the International
yeah.
Center for Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. It looks like it's got some very interesting folks, and some of them are these, you know, David Oakes and other folks from groups that have been fighting psychiatric oppression, as they term it, for many years.
Right,
I don't know if there are any...
2 months later, I'm speaking to a psychiatric conference of, like, the psychoanalysts.
Have you been invited by the Scientologists? I should say, for those who are interested, they term themselves the Citizens Commission on Human Rights.
Right.
And I'm not going to belabor this point much longer. I'd like to see a broad coalition against this, and I'm wary of people who want to, the idea, not people, but of a person adopting the idea that, well, you know, I don't want to be considered disreputable, so I won't associate with her, and then I won't associate with him. But the
right.
problem is they're going to smear you with this anyway. You know that. You've been called an anti-psychiatric Scientologist nut regardless, right?
I guess that's true. Actually, though, here's, you know, you make a good point, okay? You do make a good point. And I certainly have, you know, spoken at Mind Freedom events, et cetera, which, you know, you think of as a consumer group, and it would be ridiculous not to speak to consumer groups. Interestingly, here's the thing. I mean, I absolutely hear what you're saying, okay? And why not just speak to anybody who invites you, and maybe that's what, you know, I should do.
Well, you might draw the line at George Bush or the Nazi Party.
Right. One does have to have standards, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's you know, maybe it is unfair, but that's it, and here's what's thing I think that's interesting. Let me just one sense. There have, you know, these things, these slings and arrows have been tossed my way, such as by Larry Goldman. But the truth of the matter is I've also been invited by very mainstream groups to talk. And the reason is because they know, in fact, that I just go over the evidence. And so, for example, I got invited to do an article in a medical journal, and that synopsis was picked up by British Journal of Medicine, et cetera. And the point is, it's to maintain that sense of just going over the facts, and that's the, I think, one of the good things, in fact, that have happened for me for the last couple of years in response to this book, is, in fact, although some people have tried to put me in the anti-psychiatry camp, the truth is I'm not there. I don't come out of this in any sort of ideological fashion. And as a result, I have been invited to the other side as well somewhat, even though sometimes the hostile, you know, some sort of hostile people in the audience. So is it the smartest thing to, is it the fairest thing to do? Maybe not. And I've never I don't say anything against Scientology because, you know, that would not be fair. But I guess it's just sort of a practical response. But I understand your criticism.
Which brings
it.
Us
Makes
to
sense.
The second part of Caribou's question, which has to do with another criticism, which some have launched against you from the right and perhaps even from the left, that they're trying to pin you down, and you've actually just said that, what your position is on questions like, is schizophrenia a social construct? Is it a real biochemical or behavioral condition? What are other mental illnesses as well, so-called mental illnesses, in your view? And is that even relevant to the study you've undertaken, which, again, I want to point out for new people who've just tuned in, shows that essentially you've shown that psychotropic and other psychiatric medications have actually produced not only more harm than good, but they're actually exponentially increasing the condition that they claim to treat. That isn't that what in essence you're claiming?
Well, yes. Well, let's just you raised a couple things here.
Sure.
The book focuses on schizophrenia. Okay, and yes, the evidence that I review in that book, I think, powerfully shows that the drugs over time have done more harm than good. Now, it may be that there's a group within the people, this population so treated, that do better on the drugs. But on the whole, it's pretty clear from the evidence that the drugs do more harm than good. They do increase the chronicity. Basically, what they do there's two problems. If you don't treat people with the drugs, and even those people diagnosed with schizophrenia, there's going to be a percentage that would recover from their, you know, whatever serious distress that gets them said to be schizophrenic. And we'll come back to this whole question of diagnosis. But let's say people really are descending into some sort of serious mental distress. They get diagnosed with schizophrenia. Now, if you don't treat with drugs, there's going to be a percentage of people that are basically going to recover from that descent into serious distress. And once they recover, they're going to get along fairly well over the long term, okay? With the drugs, you trap them into this chronic condition, everybody basically, once you keep them on the drugs. And what shows up in the evidence, let's keep talking about people diagnosed with schizophrenia, is you in fact see evidence of more serious psychotic episodes with people so treated over time. That's the first problem. You certainly see all sorts of problems, extra problems of people coming abruptly off the drugs, becoming worse off than if they had never been so treated with the drugs. And then third, of course, you see all sorts of serious side effects, whether it be tardive dyskinesia, obesity, lack of motivation, et cetera, early death. So with the drugs used to treat schizophrenia, you see all sorts of serious side effects, and at least with the old drugs, Haldol, Thorazine, et cetera, you see this increase in psychotic vulnerability over time. You see this increased chronicity.
A quick interruption, Bob. For those who want an alternate source than your book, Mad in America, they're saying, sure, that's his view. Can you give a couple of alternate sources that you think even perhaps your hostile audiences might consider at least worth giving a look at?
Well, first of all, you keep saying it's my view, my claim, et cetera.
No, I mean, I do, because we're talking to you, but...
Right, right. All I'm saying is, this argument I make, I guess, is what you would say, it's by reviewing the evidence, it's by reviewing the trials and studies that have been done in a very sort of complete fashion.
Is yours the first where this has been done, or is there a previous person or other people who've done this since that have confirmed this?
Oh, sure. I mean, in terms of just general sort of critiques of... Here's the best critique of psychiatric drugs of the sort that I really like, and that is, what does the research show? Spectrum.
And the
antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, antipsychotic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find, what these people, reviewers, have found, looking again at the medical evidence, is time and time again they have found this paradigm. You may get some benefit over a short period with these psychiatric drugs, let's say over a six-week period, on the target symptom. So you'll see a lessening of that symptom as defined by the doctors that is greater with the drugs than with placebo. Okay? And so that becomes a rationale for their use. But what you'll see time and time again is that, A, when people come abruptly off these drugs, they tend to be worse off than the placebo patients. And B, just over time, the drug-treated patients, or in long-term studies, aren't doing as well as a group as the placebo patients. But get that book. It's called From Placebo to Panacea. It comes from a number of scholars, and scholars, people that are not associated with, Peter Bragan has done some nice critiques of this. Joseph Glenmullen has done a nice critique of the antidepressants. But actually, I think From Placebo to Panacea...
Who's the editor?
Pardon me?
Who's the editor or the author?
It's Greenberg and Fisher, I believe.
Okay, Greenberg and Fisher, From Placebo to Panacea.
Right, and it's by John... the publisher is John...
It's good enough. People can Google for it, and they can find it.
And it is a very sober, straightforward book, critiques of these drugs based on the evidence, and you'll see that paradigm leap out at you. And again, it's based on thorough, solid reviews of the long-term studies that have been done.
Jane here hasn't been able to get a word in edgewise, or perhaps hasn't chosen to. She's been doing some furious writing, though, and a lot of questions.
Remember the construct question, because I still want to answer that.
And I think that's one that we can, maybe, Jane, you can focus on, which is, from the left, I know you've been criticized, Bob, because you have... Should I call you Bob or Robert? What do you want to be called?
Bob is fine.
Okay. You've been criticized because you give some credibility to what some victims of psychiatry and psychiatric survivors organizations call, some of them call, a fictitious condition, the idea of a schizophrenia or psychosis. These are labels that are stigmas and categories. Isn't that your feeling, Jane?
Well, in my experience, it is so easy to get labeled mentally ill, and usually when you get that label, you get two or three diagnoses. Say you're labeled schizophrenic, and the next shrink you see labels you manic depressive, and then they have to toss a coin to see which one they want, you know, or maybe they want to keep you on both labels, but it's just so fictitious to me that in a 5-minute interview, the expert psychiatrist or professional can tell a child or the parent that their child has ADD, or that an elderly person has Alzheimer's, or that a person has manic depressive or schizophrenic. And so then that says to them that they need to treat you. And the only treatments that psychiatry has at this time seem to be the psychiatric drugs. Electroshock didn't go away in the 30s. It is very, very popular. And the other...
A little psychosurgery would be nice, too. But what about them spinning chairs we've heard of? I haven't seen them around lately.
Well, even the modern treatments, the therapies are like torture of the spinning chair. And they are used to put terror and fear in the hearts of those who are experiencing.
They're just trying to help you, Jane.
And that's what their intention was in the early days. That is what their intention is in this year, 2004.
Getting back to this question, though, which is what I think Caribou raised and what you're about to answer, Bob, what I was asking you about, Jane, is what about this schizophrenia, this word, or manic depression, or people from the left, or I don't know if they're from the left, from one side would say you are dignifying social control categories that benefit pharmaceutical companies and the psychiatric establishment, when what we're really dealing with are human problems that don't have the same kind, they don't have real physical correlates in the way that other physical illnesses do. In your research, I know you've tried to maintain a staid neutrality here, an objectivity, but have you, in your book, I think you do, although some accuse you otherwise of not doing this, you have pretty much looked simply to the data. In the last two or three years, has your position changed at all? Has it developed? When people say to you, is there such a thing as any of these conditions? Do they have reality? What's your answer on that?
Yes, this is a tough. Here's the thing is, I absolutely have charted the middle course on this question, and there's a reason for it. Basically, because I think there's some evidence to chart a middle course. First of all, it's clearly that people slap labels on people very quickly, and that those slapping of labels on people can be very damaging. That's number one. Number two, it's clear that, you know, these diagnostic categories change over time. One minute it's manic bipolar or whatever. It's bipolar. Next minute there's, you know, reclassifying that person as something else, or schizophrenia becomes bipolar, et cetera, et cetera.
And you pointed out the categories have expanded from, what, 20 or 30 after the Second World War to hundreds now?
Oh, it's hundreds. And, in fact, if you look at the percentage of people that, say, were defined as seriously mentally ill in the 1800s, compared to today, it's like an 80-fold increase today. So clearly, we are dramatically expanding the boundaries of what is, quote, mental illness.
80-fold increase, you mean, whereas one was considered mentally ill, now the 80 people are considered mentally ill?
That's right, as a percentage of the population.
As a percentage, that's a huge increase.
Yeah, and obviously, a lot of that is just marketing, and it's a lot of, expanding diagnostic categories so you can sell drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that critique of modern psychiatry is correct in that sense. But in my opinion, it goes too far in this regard. If you look at people, let's say, diagnosed with the most serious category, and that is, you know, schizophrenia. Now, clearly, there are plenty of people so diagnosed who have been diagnosed for ludicrous reasons. And Caribou talking about, because she didn't shave her legs above the knees, I mean, you know, that's ludicrous. However, I do believe that it's quite clear that people can descend into a place where they really aren't seeing the world right. I mean, that they are really struggling with their minds in profound ways, and a way that I think does deserve a definition of psychotic. Now, the causes of that, I think they can be many, and they can be, in fact, severe social distress, severe trauma in your background, tied in with not sleeping, maybe tied in with abusing street drugs, et cetera, et cetera. I also do think, though, there is a certain percentage, and I'll tell you why I believe this, that really do have something fundamentally that has gone amiss in terms of how they process information, so that you would say that there is some biological problem there, even though we don't know what the biological problem is. And the reason I believe this is that if you look in instances where they have tried to, they take people newly diagnosed in this manner and tried to treat it without drugs. And this, whether it be in certain U.S. programs or certain in Finland and Sweden, et cetera, you'll see that there's about a core group of 30-40% that really don't get better, that seem to become chronically ill and struggle with repeated episodes of psychosis, et cetera, et cetera. So what that says to me is that if we take 100 people so diagnosed, that there may be 30, 35, 40% of people that really do have something biological going on that is preventing them from, say, processing information in a manner that doesn't lead to this distress and these sort of behaviors, et cetera, et cetera. But it also means that maybe 60%, in fact, are suffering from something else, whether it be, like I said, trauma-based things, et cetera. Now, so you can see why I criticize by both sides. I don't take either side. I don't think we know what the biology is in any case. But what I do think is that in certain instances, it may be biological. In almost a disease sort of model that applies to, you know, other ailments, et cetera.
But it
clearly can many times be not that. That it can be a social construct. It can people be suffering from problems of living. And then the final thing is, mm-hmm. that still leaves us with the question is, does this paradigm of care we have, drugs for all, does it lead to better outcomes? Or is it leading to more chronic illness in our society? Is it leading to all sorts of side effects, et cetera? So you still have the question of whether the drugs are effective, whether this paradigm of care is effective. And personally, just to finish this up, is this battle between it's a social construct versus whether it's a biological ailment, in some ways, that battle has been going on now for some time. And it's not getting us to a place where, regardless of which side you come on, whether, to my mind, we're getting better outcomes or helping people in distress better. So in a way, I think it's an argument that maybe we need to move on and just look at the sense of
what can
we
do?
Doing something now that helps people.
And what can we do to help people if what we're doing now is not, in fact, is injuring people?
Exactly. What changes do we need to make? And I do think, you know, clearly people can enter a place where they need help. I mean, it's not that they never need help. That's not true. People can become severely distressed in ways they can use some help, and I do believe that.
There's actually, now that you mention it, somebody on the chat room here has got an experience and a question for you.
Okay.
She or he wishes to remain anonymous. It would be nice if I could get off my meds. The side effects are not noticeable right now, but there may be effects in the future, except every time I try to get off the med, Risperdal, even slowly over several months, I get paranoid again. I would need a few months of just not working to really get off these meds, something not available to us in Western countries. And let's see, a little bit more here. There's a question of whether the paranoia is worse when I try to go off the meds than it was before I ever took any meds. Of course, when I was first offered the meds, there was not even a five-minute interview. The doc talked to me on the phone for a minute or two and then offered the meds. So any suggestions for this chat?
No, this is a great point. And this is what one person has dubbed the neuroleptic trap. And that is, and this does show up in the evidence. So you take someone who comes to a doctor, and for whatever reason this person did, and very quickly they're put on risperidone. Now, risperidone is a pretty powerful antipsychotic. It's not actually that far different from Haldol and some of its effects. And the evidence does show what happens is when you go on a drug like this, let's say risperidone, which profoundly blocks dopamine activity, your brain does undergo some changes in response to that. And as a result of that is when you try to come off it, you basically, and they found this in the 70s, you may experience these symptoms like paranoia, psychosis, et cetera, that are worse than you would have if never exposed to the drugs. So that's why you feel like I can't get off the drugs, because in fact I start feeling these symptoms, and you can see the trap there. If they had never been put on the drugs in the first place, maybe they could have got through whatever distressful period they are, and they wouldn't be confronted now with trying to get off a drug that they're worried about long-term side effects. But yet when they try to now, they have this descent into some very distressful symptoms. So A, that problem has shown up way back in the 70s, people did talk about it, and then they just avoided it. And that's actually why you started getting this paradigm, keep the people on the drugs forever because it's so difficult to come off. All I can tell you is this. They haven't done a lot of these studies, but when they have done gradual withdrawal studies, trying to help people go off drugs slowly, where they gradually cut off the risperidone or whatever it might be, the meta-analysis done by Harvard doctors found that about a third did indeed relapse, and relapse meaning they suffered a return of symptoms serious enough to be rehospitalized or whatever, but that the 65% who could get through a six-month withdrawal period without relapsing had an excellent chance of remaining well indefinitely. So I guess the point is, if you could get under a form of care, if you were on this drug, where someone could monitor you or help you as you very slowly try to reduce your dosage of risperidone. You know, that's what I think one would like to see, to have that opportunity. Because long-term, there are certainly every reason to be concerned about long-term effects of antipsychotic drugs like risperidone.
Jane has a comment.
Yeah, the whole idea of detoxification opportunities for people who want to get off of the psychiatric drugs because they are so dangerous, I do not know where they would be. As far as there is a psychiatrist, David Richman, who wrote a book on psychiatric drugs, and people can get that through the Mad Pride people. The Mind Freedom Support Coalition that David Oakes is in. And they have a mad market, and their books really, along with drug detoxification and the true effects of the psychiatric drugs and information like that. I guess you know about that.
Yes, I do.
You're in Boston. I was wondering, do you know anything about Zuzu's place?
Yeah, I do know about Zuzu's place.
And do they allow professionals in that, or is it all run by people who have survived the torture in psychiatry?
And also tell us, the two of you, what Zuzu's place is, for those of us who don't know.
Well, Zuzu's place was started by a psychologist named Dan Kriegman, who, with the idea he would find a house where people with psychiatric diagnoses, etc., could go and live, and it would be their, you know, place of shelter, and that the idea in terms of drugs, it would be whatever people wanted. If they wanted to use psychiatric drugs, that'd be fine. If they didn't, that would be fine as well. And there was, I think, something of some of the initial people who moved there had a sense that they wanted to be off the drugs or were off the drugs. The Zuzu's place has now shut down. It just couldn't keep it going financially. And I think for some reasons for that, and basically it was a pretty high-priced house they bought, and therefore to try to recoup the expenses on the mortgage, it was hard to get people who could pay enough. I mean, I think financially they found themselves into a bind. The other thing I think that Zuzu's place learned is that this was not being run by psychiatrists. It really was the thought that it would be consumer-driven, the consumers would make the rules of the house, et cetera, et cetera. But I think for that sort of place to be successful, you need some very strong leadership of a consumer group behind the house, more than just the individuals that come into the house, say one here, one there, et cetera. And you need this more coherent group. And there's a group in Western Mass called the Freedom Center that is looking to move towards building a house of some sort. And that group has had time to season itself with consumer meetings, and it's all consumer-led. And then the consumers that are leading it, consumers, I'm just using the word that, I don't really like that word, but you know what I mean. It's led by people who've been in the system, got off their drugs, now very thoughtful, very sort of motivated people, and they've had these monthly meetings. They believe in information. They believe in, you know, people taking control of their lives. And that group is so solid now and so well led, I can see that sort of house succeeding there. But Zuzu's place didn't have this sort of core leadership behind it that I think it needed. So it doesn't exist right now. I mean, it's shut down, I believe.
Thank you.
You know, talking, I think, about solutions, which it's hard to do, but you do talk about them in your book, Mad at America, referring back to the model of the Quakers in the 1830s and 40s. Now, even that was adopted for a while by states in the United States. And I think you also talk about Soteria House a little bit, and you talked about it in your emails to me earlier. And I guess Dr. Mosher, who recently died, was involved with that. I know maybe this is a sort of a distant relative of R.D. Lang's Kingsley Hall, although perhaps that was a more radical model.
No, there's definitely a connection to them. No question about it.
He was a... Go ahead.
Well, the moral therapy did arise from the Quakers in, you know, the early 1800s. And here's why I think...
Explain what that is for folks who might not know.
Well, okay, moral therapy came from meaning tending to the emotions. It did not mean, you know, what we think of moral in some sense of a value system, right? The phrase moral therapy came from a French word meaning tending, like I said, to the emotions of the body. But then the Quakers, and so it really, that term got started with some French reforms out of the French Revolution. But then what really became transported to the United States was a form of therapy developed by the Quakers in York, England, which basically had this philosophy. And again, we're talking about people severely distressed, people who may have been put away at that time in insane asylums in England, et cetera, et cetera. We don't know what goes wrong with people that leads them to become, quote, insane. But what we do believe is this. We believe they're brethren. They're human beings. They're like us. They're not different from us. They're like us. And therefore, they will respond. They need the same things we all need. Well, what does that mean? It means shelter. It means food. It means a place to be in society. It means exercise, sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea was that they would set up shelters, homes, fairly small in size, where someone who, again, suffering severe distress, seen as insane, would go and be treated in this manner. And there were a number of such small asylums set up in the United States in the early 1800s. And what's so interesting is what did they find? Well, they found that, here's the first thing they found, that over 50% of those so treated who were coming in for their initial bout of insanity would be released within the first 12 months. Okay? They would get better. And by the way, this means we were avoiding things like straitjackets, other things to control people, et cetera. Spinning chairs, they put them out. They didn't use spinning chairs. They didn't use the bleeding, et cetera. None of those harsh things to, quote, control people.
Was in the 1840s or so?
Yeah, it starts actually around 1820. And the best the period that where they keep in this small model basically runs to 1840, 1845, 1850. That's the first thing. And historians have gone back and looked at it, and they said, yes, you see that over and over again. First-time patients, over half discharged in within 12 months. Then there was a long-term follow-up done of patients that came to Worcester Asylum when it was still run basically in a moral treatment manner in around 1845 to 1850, and they followed them up for the course of their lives. And what they found, of those discharged, something like 58% never came back to the asylum.
How did that compare with those who did at that time?
What's that? I'm not sure.
How did that compare with the discharges from... were there other alternate groups that were using, you know, seclusion and restraints and lock them away and spinning chairs and bleeding?
Well, no, actually what happened was, if you follow this, okay, the seclusion chairs, the lock away and all that stuff, that got started with the first sort of wave of care for the, quote, insane in the United States, say around 1770, and that was replaced by moral therapy as the desired form of care around 1820. And although you had plenty of places where people were mistreated, county jails, that sort of thing, the form of care that was seen as best was this moral therapy. Then what did happen is, in fact, moral therapy, these small asylums were seen as so successful, the idea was, well, we've got to make this available to, you know, the population at large, to an ever larger group of people. And we went into this wave of asylum building in the 1850s and 1860s. And actually, it was well-meaning. But what happened is, when we went into this wave of asylum building, building ever bigger facilities, they started dumping everybody into them, people with syphilis, end-stage dementia, old age, you know, senility, et cetera, et cetera. And they became very huge. So they basically became warehouses for, you know, nursing home-type places. And so the number of people who got better rapidly declined because they were no longer small facilities. And as they became larger, they started re-implementing straitjackets, some harsher therapies, et cetera. And so we got away from moral therapy, and moral therapy came to be seen as a failed therapy. But what failed was not small homes, small shelters for people, say, younger, who were, you know, entering this period of severe distress. What failed was 2,000 patient facilities that took in people with syphilis, alcohol poisoning, end-stage dementia, along with the insane, and didn't give them any sort of real care. But unfortunately, moral therapy came to be seen as failed once we moved to this different type of care. And absolutely, at that point, you see the discharge rates absolutely plummet. They decline dramatically. But the thing that to remember here today is we keep being told that, quote, schizophrenia is a lifelong condition, right? Or manic depressive, it's a lifelong condition, and you need to be on these drugs forever. But if we go back and look at moral therapy, what do we see? We see a heterogeneous spectrum of outcomes, in other words, varied type of outcomes, and we see 50 to 60% of people, even those labeled seriously insane, get better and not come back to the asylum. So that tells you that, in fact, this idea that once insane, once severely mentally ill, you're going to be mentally ill for life, it's just not true. And we need a system today that allows sort of this escape valve for those who can recover to recover. And the other thing to remember is that was when we were talking a very small percentage of the population that was seriously disturbed. Even that group had these recovery rates. Now we're drawing this huge, big circle where we say 15, 20% of the population is mentally ill and mentally ill for life, you know, and they need these drugs for life. Well, of course, that's nonsense. But the point is, even if we kept, so we have two problems. One, we got to, as a society, not be drawing this huge boundary, because once you draw this huge circle and invite so many people in to be mentally ill, you really are screwing up a lot of lives, and you're putting on a path to chronic illness with these drugs. That's the first problem. And then second of all, even within this smaller circle of people severely disturbed when they enter the system, we got to remember that group alone has a good percentage of people who could recover. But instead, what do? We draw this huge wide circle, say somehow it's a biological thing, you're not going to recover, you've got to stay up on drugs for life, and that system is an absolute failure, and it is ruining many lives.
We're talking with Robert Whitaker, author of Mad in America. In the studio with me here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, or www.freakradio.org on your internet, is Mad Jane Kaiser, and, of course, the notorious Caribou Lawn. I'm Robert Norris, and if you have questions you want to pass on to the panelists or to Robert, get on pagesincolor.com. That's all one word, pagesincolor.com, www.pagesincolor.com. Click into the chat room, write in your name, and you can just pass on the question. I will pass it on to Robert. You cannot call in now because we've only got one phone line.
I have a comment, Robert.
Uh-huh. Wait a minute. No, you have to go to Pages and... Okay, you can go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm Caribou, and what Bob was just saying about never having to go back into an asylum. In my circumstance, I was diagnosed schizophrenic, and I guess I've never recovered yet. I haven't had been reassigned any other kind of label. And yet, oddly enough, I was never allowed to go into any kind of asylum or any kind of hospital, because every time I would, when the doctors would want me to, they would want me to go there on my own, and then the staff would say, "You're not sick enough to be in here." And yet, I was going along like a good child and trying. I even went a second time to try to do that, and I wasn't allowed to go in. But I found that I still am, you know, affected by this association with the disease or the condition by having somewhat depressed or anger feelings. And then on the other side, I can go to a feeling where this is not relevant to my life. So in that regard, I guess you could say it's a point of view and it's a state of mind. Maybe it's an organic condition, but it's something where I've learned to adapt my lifestyle around all the other kind of presumptions that I should be a certain way. And I have found in the last few years that one form of treatment for people that can't take this medication might be somewhat, it's a physical condition where your body is changed by going into it's a Native American kind of treatment that's you go and you're closer to the earth by going into an ipis or sweat lodges where you are physiologically changed, and it's a spiritual release. It's a spiritual celebration of yourself, and and your feelings about life, and it's also a physical change, but it's not a permanent feeling where you're addicted to anything. And I think I'm going to stop there right now.
Have you seen anything like that, Bob? In your
a couple things here. I mean, can I ask one quick question, then I'll comment it. When you were going to the hospital, did you want a place that you needed, like, shelter for a time? Is that why you were presenting at the hospital? I mean, did you feel like you needed a place of comfort or something? Or why did you go to the hospital?
Oh, thanks for asking. My doctor at the time thought that if she could just get my medication regulated, she thought that I wasn't responding well enough to it, and or it was either too much or something, and they would give me enough. They would do it right.
Right.
Did you feel bad yourself, independently of her authoritative opinion? I mean, were you in distress yourself at that point?
I had my problems at the time. I think of different ways about what caused some of those issues to come up.
Did you feel you had to go, as Bob said, into a place of comfort, did you think, doctor thinks it's good to regulate
me? I thought
me.
The doctor knew best, yes.
The doctor knew best. Jane has a comment here. Hang on a second, Bob.
The place of comfort, do not think that those are safe and helpful places. The acute wards, the psychiatric acute wards are not. In fact, they produce the most awful side effects for life, the
right.
memories.
Not
of
to mention
the
psychiatric
torture.
Medications.
Yeah.
You know, they're not safe. They say the mental health system and psychiatry says, here, come and we'll help you. We'll help your loved ones. There is no help or care inside those places.
Bob?
Well, two things, a number of things. I do believe that people can reach a time when they need help, right? And sometimes they'll self-seek that help, et cetera, for whatever reason. And therefore, you know, as a society, we need some response. Question is, what is that response? And two, in terms of type of places that exist, psychiatric wards, emergency wards, etc. You know, there are plenty of awful places, no question about it. I hate to label them all bad, though, because I think there are some. The problem is they're so geared to drugging and all that sense. But you know, I certainly have met people working in facilities that I think are well-meaning and actually do care about people and want to help people. I just hate to, you know, tar everyone or, you know, in sort of in that situation
but
with
you,
the same
you
brush.
Asked, you asked
I'm
Coral,
not sure it's fair.
You asked Coral a question about this.
Right. That's how we got going.
Yeah, get back on.
And that's what I was wanting to get. So thank you for bringing me back. And here's this going. This question. I do. And this is, and she goes in, she gets labeled, the person gets labeled, et cetera, and then they're told to get drugs, and that becomes like a life-changing event. And this is where I do agree with the criticisms. I don't know how helpful it is to say this person's manic, bipolar, this person's schizophrenic, et cetera, especially since we know that those diagnostic categories change over time, or so loose, et cetera. It seems to me that if we had a system that was humble and said, and this would come out of it, is we don't know what causes, you know, how people end up in these periods of distress, et cetera, or behaviors that may be very scary to themselves and scary to others, et cetera. But we do know that maybe what we do need to provide is some sort of safe place, some sort of place where people can recuperate, and let's offer hope rather than this sense of, oh, you're going to be sick for life, you have a bad brain, et cetera. So if we made hope, and we made the sense that, and it came out of this humility that we saw in the Quakers, and we said, we believe in the possibility of recovery. We believe that this can be a temporary phenomenon. And we believe that, yeah, brethren, and what do brethren need when they hit this period? Well, they need sleep, they need food, they need a place to be, they may need support finding a job, they may need support building up social networks, et cetera, et cetera. And then, if we say, and some people may do better with you know, a psychiatric drug, if that becomes, you know, sort of a selective use mechanism, then I think that's a thoughtful form of care. But it's a form of care that puts hope, the sense that we don't know why people, you know, enter this period of distress, but it doesn't mean you have a broken brain. It doesn't mean you're, quote, mentally ill, different, defective, any of those things that those labels imply. It just means you're a human being, that to have distress is something that human beings are very vulnerable to have forms of serious distress, paranoia, even psychosis. That is indeed part of the human condition. And it doesn't mean defective, and it doesn't mean you should remove hope from that person. And I think if we had a form of care that put hope and getting back on your feet as the central focus, that would be a much more humane system, and actually a system based on what we do or don't know about mental distress.
What kind of hope, Bob, have you found in the last 3 years after the publication of your book, which kind of lays bare the fact that certain kinds of psychiatric drugs actually, and we specifically talk about the mechanism. You talk about how dopamine receptors are actually increased by the use of certain psychiatric drugs, that this has been documented in studies, and that, of course, essentially causes a brain pathology. In your latest notes, you talk about serotonin receptors being reduced. I mean, I was kind of go back and forth between the dopamine and the serotonin.
Right.
I don't want to get technical for people who are listening in necessarily, but I'm getting back to the hope. In other countries, have you found any kinds of Soteria houses or Quaker treatments or Kingsley halls or different approaches? There are some who say, for example, that in the third world, the World Health Organization studies that got you originally on this path, the reason people are better off without taking medication there is because they have more support systems from family, and there's a cultural difference, and they attack your whole argument by saying it's not the psychiatric medications, it's a fundamentally culturally different background, and that's a separate argument. But getting to the hope, any kind of hope that for us here and for those listening?
Well,
or do we have to create it ourselves?
No, I mean, I both feel small moments of hope and larger moments of utter despair. And the despair, of course, because it seems like there's just this bulldozer out there that's just drawing ever more people and kids into this circle of mental illness and calling them mentally ill, and with all the, and you look at the larger statistics, the number of people disabled keeps increasing, et cetera, et cetera. The hope, I've seen a couple beacons. One, there is this Finnish program that has been going on since 69, treating people diagnosed with schizophrenia there. And in 1992, they implemented a program. It was led by a gentleman named Allenin, in which upon initial diagnosis, initial break, they would not put people on the antipsychotics. They had a mechanism which was called only when absolutely necessary. And the idea was they would try to get people through their psychotic break without exposing them to these drugs, because they had understood by this time the brain does undergo these changes that makes coming off the drug so difficult. And they've now reported long-term results, up to five-year results with a number of patients. And what they reported that in with that form of care, 40% of their patients never get exposed to the drugs at all, not one dose. The 60% who do end up getting exposed, it's generally very low doses, by the way, of Thorazine. And what percentage end up on the drugs is not clear from their reports. But their outcomes are terrific in terms of the percentage of people working after 2 years. It's over 50%, whereas, of course, we have about 10% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia working. The number of people who go back to hospitals, it's only about 12% from years 2 through 5. In other words, 88% of the people stay out of the hospital, don't go back even a single time. So you do have a model out there that is not radical. And by the way, they believe all along that you needed these other things. You needed social support. You needed mechanisms of housing, making sure people had good shelter, trying to get people into jobs, social networks, etc. So they believed in this comprehensive approach. So we do have out there, if we want to send people over there to study it and to adopt its measures, a program that's been operating for a long time, in a scientific environment, right, by people who are doing studies and all that, and showing that their results are much, much, much better than ours. So we do have an example to follow. Now, there's also a few satira-like projects that were done, I think, in Switzerland that reported good results. There was one done in Sweden that
reported
good results.
Satira-like projects? Sorry.
Satira-like projects.
A satira, right, gotcha.
Right. Modeled after Lauren Mosher's model that was done in the 70s here. And in fact, every one that I've been able to find that tried this, where you take people newly diagnosed with schizophrenia and you try to provide them shelter and these other form of comforts and only use drugs when necessary, have reported good results. Now, and this was done within mainstream medicine, where guys were willing to use the drugs, and they would report that they used the drugs selectively. But every time they reported better results than you get with the standard form of care of drugs for everybody. So, and to the sense that that message at least is not dying, is still out there, getting around, there's a little room for hope. The other beacon of hope, there's two that I think that are out there that are real powerful now. One is a program, is some change going on in Alaska. And there's a gentleman up there named Jim Gottstein who is someone who experienced the system as a patient at one point. He also happens to be a Harvard-trained lawyer. And he put together a group called psychrights.org. And he's been working to change that system both through legal challenges to the system and also by working through the mental health boards up there. And he's now very close to getting funding for Alaska to sign off on a satira-like house there. Which is really, and Alaska's interesting because of the way the system works up there. They sort of have two mental health boards that govern mental health policy. One is sort of the traditional one that comes out of agencies, et cetera. But they also have a second one because of some money that was set aside for mental health up there. And Jim actually ran a lawsuit that which won and made sure the money really went to mental health benefits. And they have a mental health board that has consumers on the board, people who've been through it, et cetera, and is much more open to alternatives. And they are now looking to set up a satira-like house. I think the hope is that it will open in 2005. It's actually gotten the blessing of this local psychiatric establishment. And what happened is he brought me up there. He brought up some other psychiatrists who could add to this sense of what does the evidence show. Is there evidence supporting a satiria house approach that you would take first? And really, two principles. A, you try to treat people who are initially diagnosed without the drugs because you don't want them to undergo these changes. And two, that you give people a chance to undergo graduate withdrawal so they can, you get as many people as possible off the drugs and living a drug-free life over the long term. And so they're moving forward with a house that would implement these two basic positions, into the form of care, which I think is wonderful. And if they could do it right, and if they could prove successful, I think that could be a force for change elsewhere. Bob. And finally, there is this group in Western Massachusetts I mentioned, the Freedom Center, that is somewhat proceeding along the same path, working closely somewhat with service providers and trying to get an alternative, a satira-like alternative established there in Western Massachusetts. But beyond that, I'm not very hopeful because you just see, you know, the economic forces at work that are medicating an ever larger number of people.
Let's talk about those economic forces, because I think that in order to maybe present a real alternative, you're going to have to find some way of making this new humane, brethren-oriented approach, you know, economically attractive, or at least make the other approach so economically unattractive through lawsuits and all kinds of other things that it gets turned around. You've mentioned in your notes to me, which you sent on email, that there's a huge economic incentive that's happened, and it kind of has a historical basis. You gave two interesting historical points. One was the change in the 1700s that suddenly gave physicians the power to put people in institutions. I guess without their okay, you wouldn't be able to get into an institution and do an asylum, which gave physicians a great economic incentive to be mad doctors, recommend therapies, control the situation. And then, of course, in 1951, the Humphrey Amendment to the...
Right.
Give me the... I don't know what the full title of it is, the food and drug laws of the earlier time, that essentially suddenly allowed doctors to prescribe medications where previously pharmacists had that power. suddenly put the doctors in bed with the pharmaceutical companies and gave them a huge financial interest, and also the pharmaceutical companies a huge financial incentive to get the doctors on board.
Right. Yeah, what happened is with the Humphrey Amendment is that the drugs that needed prescriptions, all of a sudden you consider drugs needed a prescription of a doctor, okay? So before, a doctor might recommend a drug, okay? And then the person would go to the pharmacy and get it filled, or a person might go directly to a pharmacist and get a compound filled as well. But it wasn't that there was a monopoly, basically, where you had to go through the doctors to get a prescription. But once that amendment became, the doctors became the gatekeepers of the most powerful drugs, and all of a sudden now you have to go to a doctor to get this, you know, access to these powerful pills in society. And once that happened, you see the pharmaceutical companies now courting the doctors to work with them. The sales reps start giving them gifts, et cetera, et cetera. And that's one thing. So the drug companies no longer are selling their drugs through pharmacists, et cetera. They're selling them through doctors. So now they have to court the doctors. We have doctors and pharmaceutical interests somewhat aligned. And the other thing is, so...
Skewing the studies, right?
What's that?
Skewing the studies so that the people doing the studies
suddenly
have an interest.
So, you know, they pay the doctors to do the studies, but of course they're absolutely skewing the studies. But the doctors are also in a position where, as sort of owners of the powerful pills of society, they have to be believers too, right? Because you go to them, you pay them whatever you pay, $100 for 15 minutes. Well, they have to believe that these potions they're going to prescribe are very powerful and very good, or they wouldn't do it. Now, it so happens that many drugs are very good, the antibiotics, et cetera. So there are plenty of drugs that actually attack a specific illness, and they're very, you know, wonderful.